nothing worthwhile. The recognized symbol of excellence in crappy podcasting.
Interior, locker room, night. Daniel is lying on a gurney, with Miyagi standing over him.
Mr. Miyagi?
Aye.
You think I had a chance of winning?
Win, lose, no matter.
No, that's not what I mean.
I had good chance.
Well, can you fix my leg, you know, with that thing you do?
When you do that thing you
but cut
do.
It out, Miyagi. Come on, I'm serious.
Oi. No need fight anymore. You prove a point.
What point? That I could take a beating? I mean, every time I see those guys, I'm going to know they got the best of me. I'll never have balance that way. Not with them, not with Ali, not with me.
Oi. Close eye.
What are you doing, man?
Silence.
You're making me feel uncomfortable.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Was that a deleted scene from the industry cut of The Karate Kid?
I believe it was the unrated director's cut. The late, great John Avildsen, they dug into his vault and saw some outtakes. And I think that's where that came from. I have to check the timestamp on it. But
yeah, that's back in the 80s. They were a little bit more adventurous with their filmmaking.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's what deleted scenes are for. They you know, and alternate takes. They want to, you know, they do things sometimes that are great on screen, but they don't move the story along. So I can see how they didn't choose that particular take for the, for that, you know, that's a pivotal scene right there.
Yeah, well, clearly that scene didn't move the story along. It probably would have took the story in a completely different direction.
Yeah, I mean, it moved something. It just didn't move the story.
Yeah, legal fees. It moved legal fees.
Yeah.
It moved commerce from one attorney to another. But you know what I always say, Gru?
What do you
podcast
always say?
Here. Podcast here. Podcast never here. Well, again, let's introduce. We are America's number one bi-coastal podcast featuring two annoying Jews. The name of the show is Nothing Worthwhile. Representing the West Coast in a somewhat chilly Phoenix, Arizona, I am your host and moderator, Evan Moody. On the East Coast, I'm not sure what we're going to call him today. Is it, I guess, still Mr. Rest in Panama, deleted scene from Karate Kid, the great Andrew Gruthius in the great city of Coral Springs, Gru? How the hell are you, my friend?
Staying dry. It's been raining all morning and all day, really. But doing fine. I'd like to wish my dear friend and partner a happy 50th birthday. Sorry to release your age to all our fans in India, but yes, Evan has turned the big 50 yesterday. So congratulations to you and happy birthday.
Do you really ever congratulate somebody on turning 50?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a milestone. You know, for guys like us, for us to be able to turn 50 with the damage we've done to ourselves, to our brains alone, with the crap that we watch and listen to, for us to make it that far is an accomplishment.
Yes, well,
I haven't made it there yet, but you have, so
you will make it, and
it is congratulatory.
I really appreciate it. I thought it was somewhat ironic. My friends got me a cameo from Bret the Hitman Hart.
Yes.
And only earlier in the week, I texted Andrew an article did I send it to you? That Eric Bischoff called Bret the Hitman Hart a whiny little bitch.
Yes, you did. That's why when you sent it to me, I was like, that's a tad ironic.
Of course, I was like, I am so honored to get a cameo from the excellence of execution.
Yeah.
And I do love Bret the Hitman Hart, but yes, he is a tad bit complainy over the years, but it was a wonderful, wonderful gift. And
he was probably complaining about having to do that cameo.
He did a nice job, actually. He did put a little extra thought into it. Clocked in just under a shade of 33 seconds. He got probably, no, I don't even know how long it was.
Isn't that about as long as the sharpshooter from Shawn Michaels lasted?
Yeah, well, I want to thank the Hasenbein boys, Mitch and Craig Hasenbein, for the cameo, and Andy said, my wonderful podcast partner, my best bud, sent me a video as well. Great move. Love the end. It was kind of like a roast on me. And then I think apparently at the end of the video, Andy stands up only to show that he was sitting on the shitter the whole time and flushed the toilet bowl. And a great final spark of creativity that went right down the drain. As most of the things involving our friendship and podcast and other travails and journeys, but it was great. It was a wonderful time, and I do want to thank my beautiful girlfriend Marie for everything. And yeah, it was great. So 50, and we will move on. All right, crew, it's time to paint the fence as Nothing Worthwhile takes a look at the first and perhaps the most iconic film that kicked off a revived franchise. It is The Karate Kid.
Yes. So,
well, Andy, before I get to it, anything to set the table with the iconic first film?
Well, I mean, the iconic first film sets the table for a plethora of, you know, I mean, we're talking, what, 84 to what? How many years is that to now? 36 years?
36
years?
94, 04, 14, yeah, 36 years.
36 years, and as hot today as it was then. It all stems back to this original movie, which is, I think we both, actually, I think you had it on your top 10 of all time.
I didn't,
but it's knocking at the door, because this is one of the, this movie changes trajectories.
Hold on.
What? What are you doing?
It's knocking at the door. What? The movie's knocking at the door. Let me interrupt real quick, because I'm hearing your comments. And so, being a movie fan, and Gru is a big-time movie guy, before you even heard of Cobra Kai, I mean, did you ever think that this was a franchise for reviving or an extension? I mean, we hear Aliens, Terminator, Rocky. You never really... I don't remember hearing Karate Kid. I mean, before you even heard of Cobra Kai, did you wish, or did you think that this was worth revisiting?
Nope, not even. Didn't. I mean, I can't say I would. If you would have asked me, would I be interested in watching a continuation of the franchise, I would have been like, hell yeah. But it's nothing I would have ever thought of. I figured after, I mean, look, to be honest, I didn't see the next Karate Kid. I did see the Karate Kid reboot, but I do not consider that.
Save your thoughts, please.
All right. But after Karate Kid 3, I figured it was over. And that's fine. You know, it's not something that was ever on the radar. It's like, you know, you don't know what you want until you get it. So that's how I look at this. But this first movie, even without everything that came after it, would still be the iconic, incredible movie that it is, was, and always will be, because it's a perfect movie. There is literally nothing. How do I put this? They don't waste a moment. Like a lot of movies, like, you know, try to get in a little joke here, a little thing there, doesn't really have much to do with anything. This is one of those perfect movies where if you take even one moment out of it, it's a different movie. And that, to me, is what a perfect movie is all about, and this is one of them. From the music to the... Yeah, all right, go ahead.
No, I just want to ask you, before we get to the actual movie, in looking back at the franchise, I really heard nothing of Cobra Kai until the promos for the new YouTube app came out. I mean, were you aware? I didn't read anything until the whole YouTube, like the Cobra Kai was going to be the tentpole television show for the new YouTube streaming, pay streaming service. I didn't read anything. Not that I do a ton of reading, but I do read a lot of entertainment-based stuff on the internet. Were you aware well prior about the beginnings of this revived franchise?
Good question. I remember the first time hearing about it. They didn't know where it was going to be. I knew they were making it, but they didn't know if it was going to be YouTube, if it was going to be a one-off episode thing, but I remember thinking like, oh, that'll be fun, and that'll be, you know, nice and stupid, and we'll just, you know, it'll be a nice throwback for a moment, and then we'll forget it ever happened. Obviously, couldn't have been more wrong, but we'll save that for the Cobra Kai episode of this month. But I knew of it, but didn't put much thought into it. It's not like I was like, oh my god, I can't wait to see this. This is going to be amazing. I was like, oh, whenever that comes on, I'll check it out. That's what it was like.
Okay, so. Interesting. But I think I probably was the same way after I heard. I was like, oh, I'll watch it, but I wasn't like, I wasn't picking up the phone, calling people. Hey, did you see? So interesting. Well, Karate Kid, 1984, American martial arts drama film, written by Robert Mark Kamen, directed by John G. Avildsen. It is the first installment of the Karate Kid franchise. Stars Ralph Macchio, Pat Morita, and Elizabeth Shue. The Karate Kid follows Daniel LaRusso, Ralph Macchio, a teenager taught Goju Ryu karate by Mr. Miyagi to help defend himself.
Goju Ryu?
That's what I have.
That's a thing? I'm offended by that. You know what? I don't like the movie anymore. I'm leaving.
Yeah, I was told in middle school, Goju Ryu. That was with the Italian kids in the playground. They used to bully us Jews. Speaking of bullies, he's going to compete in a karate tournament against his bullies, one of which is the ex-boyfriend of his love interest, Allie Mills, played by Elizabeth Shue.
Johnny wasn't the bully.
Guru, the Karate Kid, is a semi-auto... it's a semi-autobiography story based on the life of its screenwriter, Robert Mark Kamen, at the age of 17. After the 1964 New York's World Fair, Kamen was beat up by a gang of bullies. He thus began to study martial arts in order to defend himself. Kamen was unhappy with his first teacher, who taught him martial arts as a tool for violence and revenge, not as a tool for self-defense. He moved on to study Okinawan Goji Ryu Karate under a Japanese teacher who did not speak English. As a Hollywood screenwriter, Kamen was told that producer Jerry Weintraub had optioned a news article about a young child of a single mother who had earned a black belt to defend himself against the neighborhood bullies. Kamen then combined his own life story with the news article and used both to create the screenplay for Karate Kid. Additionally, given John G. Avildsen's involvement with both films, Sylvester Stallone has often joked that Karate Kid and the writer had ripped off the Rocky films with the Karate Kid. So I wanted to start off, Gru, with there are clearly some parallels with the Rocky and Karate Kid franchises and characters, and wanted to give your thoughts if you agree with that, disagree, because as I started to watch the movie, I definitely saw some parallels with both universes.
The only parallels to me are the idea, you know, one kid against, or one guy against the world, and, you know, doing the impossible training, and, you know, like, you know, and then you have the, you know, you go through a bunch of stuff, you go through a bunch of emotional stuff, then you're training, then you fight. Also with the character, you know, Rocky was, the original Rocky was a punk, and Daniel's a punk. And they both go on a similar kind of journey in self-discovery. But that's where it ends, because the richness of Karate Kid and the richness of Rocky doesn't necessarily come from the main character. It comes from all the people around them. And that's where the two films go in opposite directions, both equally mesmerizing from their,
So you don't feel the wise old coach, the romance lines of both movies, and again, sort of these macho opponents. That's kind of what I put my notes.
The reason is because those are ideas that existed way before Rocky, and Rocky ripped those off. It's not, my old boss in my previous line of work told me one time, he's like, basically, there are five stories out there and a million ways to tell them. And so, they're obviously similar stories. They've got the same director, the same guy who does the music, Bill Conti, did the Rocky movies and the Karate Kids. Yeah, all right. It's the same kind of story, but told in completely different ways. So I never think of Rocky when I'm watching The Karate Kid, and likewise, and watching Rocky, the Karate Kid never enters my mind because Sylvester Stallone and Ralph Macchio they create two completely different characters who have similar, I don't know, it's tough. Like I said, they're both kind of young punks, but yeah, they're still completely different.
I don't disagree with that. I kind of just saw some commonalities with both films. I wrote in my notes, the wise mentor coach, and they're completely different.
Yes.
But both guys rely on the coaches, lean on them heavily for their successes.
Okay.
Let me give you the romance angle. Now, obviously, nothing could touch Rocky and Adrian. However, when I watched Karate Kid again, I was fairly surprised as how much I bought into the Daniel Alley romance. They really, in the short amount of time in the movie, they give you enough there to really. It's like a high school romance, and you get all the wonderful bubbly feelings, watching two young kids fall in love in high school. And then, of course, the opponents. I mean, again, Apollo is a guy that you could like. He doesn't really have per se any negative. All right, I don't want to debate that, but not only Johnny, the Martin Cove character, these very macho sort of manly opponents, maybe even a little over the top that they have to defeat. It's nothing I want to belabor, but I just saw some commonalities. Perhaps it has to do with John G. Avildsen, and I wanted to throw it to you and ask you, what are your thoughts of him as a director?
He died recently, a couple of years ago. It's tough for me
Mixed
to say.
Bag?
Yeah, because I don't think he was a great director. I think he was lucky enough to get his hands on a couple of great scripts. Like he got Rocky and then he got The Karate Kid. He did a movie I think before Rocky called Joe with Peter Boyle, which was very good. He's got his later work, like even in the Karate Kid universe, and we're gonna get to that. There are just things, and I don't know, you're tripping me up here, but it's interesting because he did the movie Lean on Me about Joe Clark in New Jersey.
Yes.
And I like the movie, but it's not well made. It's not well directed. Morgan Freeman sells it. And makes it work. It's not well made. It's not well edited. And John Avildsen, I don't know if you have it in your notes bit there, but I believe Avildsen edited his own movies. And they're not well edited. And the best example of that is Rocky V, which is a horribly made movie. And, a guy with that kind of directing talent, should be doing better, should have done better than he did. But look, if you have a resume that has the Rocky and the Karate Kid on it, you're a legendary director. So he is a legendary director regardless of what anybody thinks of him, because those two movies speak for themselves. And but you know, he and there's a reason that he doesn't get the respect that you would expect somebody to get who has those two movies on his resume. And that's because I just don't think he was that great of a director. He got lucky. But he made gold with the gold he was given. So, you know, and no disrespect to John, rest in peace, but you know,
oh, please,
I don't like to do that, but you know, I don't think he's overrated, because I don't think he gets that much respect. But you know,
all right, let me step in. Educated at NYU, he was an assistant director on films by Arthur Penn and Otto Preminger. His first feature was the low-budget feature Joe, 1970. Mm. Got good notices for star Peter Boyle. Had further success with a low-budget 1971 cult classic comedy called Cry Uncle. Saved the Tiger, 1973, a film nominated for 3 Oscars, winning Best Actor for star Jack Lemmon. His greatest success was 1976 Rocky. Of course, as Gru mentioned, he came back again in 1990 for the not-well-received Rocky V. In between, he directed a movie in 1980 called The Formula, starring Marlon Brando and George C. Scott. He was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Director. Other films included 1981's Neighbors, 1988 For Keeps, 1989 Lean On Me, 1992, The Power of One, 1994, 8 Seconds, the first 3 karate films. He was the original directors for both Serpico and Saturday Night Fever, but he was fired over disputes with the producers. His last film was Inferno. Actually, I think it was changed the name, called Desert Heat, 1999, Jean-Claude Van Damme. So that is a quick synopsis, if you will, on Johnny G. Adelson.
Spotty record, but like I said, with Rocky and the original Rocky and the original Karate Kid, you know, you are a legend. So, you know, I can leave it there.
John Adelson died June 16, 2017, Andrew, in Los Angeles. He was 81 years old. The cause of his death was a pancreatic cancer. So again, as we say on the show, rest in Panama, John. Rest in Panama, sweet prince. All right, let's get to a group casting. A number of actors were considered for the part of Daniel, including
I'm stuck on sweet prince.
Including Sean Penn, Robert Downey Jr., Charlie Sheen, Emilio Estevez, Nicolas Cage.
So basically the Brad Pack of the
Anthony Edwards, Thomas Cruise, and Eric Stoltz. Ralph Macchio Gru was ultimately selected on the strength of his performance as Johnny Cade in The Outsiders, 1983. Macchio has stated his performance as Johnny influenced the development of Daniel LaRusso in his next film, which of course was The Karate Kid. So, Gru, you did throw out Brat Pack.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on some of those names that were considered for the role of Daniel LaRusso?
Yeah, well, look, hindsight is 2020, but as you mentioned some names, I'm thinking of the way they would have played it. And Macchio, far and away, made the absolute greatest choices as an actor for it. I think Sean Penn would have played it more brooding. You mentioned Tom Cruise probably would have, although he wasn't in his, he wasn't in his Mission Impossible phase yet, but he was probably too, and this is no slight to my, what did you call it?
Do you not like Tom Cruise?
I like Tom Cruise to me is someone.
Answer the question, damn it.
Yes.
Okay,
yes. And I think he could be doing, he's a much better actor than people give him credit for, because he doesn't do it enough. Like, if you look at his performance in, like, Born on the 4th of July, you could, and Rain Man.
I love it.
Rain, no, yeah. I'm saying, Rain Man and Born on the 4th of July, and to an extent, The Color of Money, that's the Tom Cruise that I'm a fan of. Not the Mission Impossible guy, not the Night and Day guy, not
the, he's actually
not the
great
Edge of
in
Tomorrow.
The mission.
I think like Bond, it's all the frickin' same. And even all Top right. Gun, you know, like he gets drowned out by all the nonsense around him. But you put him in like Magnolia, you know, the support, he was nominated for a supporting actor Oscar for Magnolia because he actually gets to act instead of just jump from one set piece to another. And I think he would have been a little too flashy for this. I think he was coming off of Risky Business, so he was a star by then. Macchio was
coming up. Do you think Tom Cruise would have played it like in the karate tournament? He would have had like no shirt on, like baby oil all
probably,
over his chest.
Probably. I think, and I don't think that would have been his idea. I think the producers probably would have wanted him to do it. Macchio was actually perfect because he's a good-looking guy, but he's not like We established several podcasts ago that he was my, what do you call it?
Celebrity crush.
Celebrity crush. Yeah, the male celebrity crush. Yeah, well, you know, he was my hero when I was a kid, but he was nothing special as far as a specimen. You know, the guy, half the guys or more of the guys you mentioned over there probably more technically handsome than he is. He's kind of a skinny runt in the movie. He's definitely not built. Cruise was always like buff like that. This guy was perfect. He kind of looked like a wimp with the attitude of a little punk, which was exactly what the character needed to be. And those other people that you mentioned, I think like even Emilio Estevez has too much of an edge to him for a role like that. You don't look at Emilio Estevez and look at him and see him as an underdog. You take all these guys and you see them there. They walk into a room. They're the ones everyone focuses on. Macchio was the perfect one who could literally slip into a room and go unnoticed, which is not a knock against him because he takes it from 0 to 1,000 the moment this movie starts. And that's why it's perfect casting.
All right, I got a crowbar in because Andy will spend 50 minutes musing on Anthony Edwards. Speaking of which, Macchio later commented the character was originally named Danny Weber. As soon as I walked into the room, I changed it to LaRusso.
sounds like a third grade English teacher, Mr. LaRusso.
No, it just you know, it does fit that. In all honesty, it does fit that sort of East Coast New Jersey vibe, which the character is from.
Yeah, Weber is kind of like a Jewish name, isn't it?
I just think it's like Middle America. Like there's Webers all over the world. LaRusso, you kind of know it's. I'm from Philly. Yes, I'm from
name,
New York.
Yeah, the
know?
Name like that. That's a, if that's true. That's that. That the name has to stick. It's got to be a memorable name, and that's certainly one that you don't forget once you hear it once. You know?
The studio originally wanted the role of Mr. Miyagi to be played by Toshiro Mifune, who had appeared in the film Rashomon, 1950, Seven Samurai, 1954.
Yojimbo, right? Was he in Yojimbo?
Who?
Was he in Yojimbo?
God bless you. But the actor didn't speak any English. Pat Morita later auditioned for the role but rejected it, was rejected for the part due to his close association with stand-up comedy and the character Arnold on Happy Days. After a few failed attempts, Morita grew a beard and patterned his accent after his uncle, which led him being cast in the role. Reading this now, it does make me remember that Pat Morita was essentially a supporting comedic actor, as I remember him, for most of his career. Pretty wild stuff, huh?
Yes, and talk about, again, you know, for some reason I'm drawing blanks here, but like, I can't imagine the movie with anybody else other than him. And yeah, I do remember Happy Days. You know, it was a little before my time, but yeah, I think this was like the only like dramatic role he ever did. Everything else was comedic because he's a funny guy and he's funny in this. But
yeah,
you know,
I think he did that really terrible movie with Jay Leno. It was like a
Collision Course. Yes, Collision Course. God. Of course, I have it on my queue on Netflix.
I absolutely we have to do a Collision Course podcast.
He was in. He did have a very funny part in Honeymoon in Vegas. Do you remember him in that? He was the limo driver. He played a blind limo driver in some crappy TV movie with like Gary Coleman. You know, like that's the kind of stuff he was doing. So to cast him in this, took a lot of balls and he paid off big time. I mean, like literally, he is. There's no other. There's no other Miyagi. You can't. You just can't replace him. He's all right. There's your comparison. There's nobody else who could play Mickey other than Burgess Meredith. That was a money shot that they got with Burgess Meredith. And same thing here. You know, I think Burgess Meredith at the time was his career was not what it was not what it used to be. He was sort of way past his prime. And they didn't have a lot of money to go after, somebody, a bigger name. So they kind of settled for him, and he got nominated for an Oscar, as did Pat Morita for Karate Kid.
All right, well, let's stay on topic with Karate Kid. And speaking of balls, Demi Moore was also considered for the role as Ali, but Elizabeth Shue was cast partly on a National Burger King commercial that became widely popular in the 1980s. Crispin Glover was considered for the role of Johnny, but the studio later opted for, I think here is really critical casting, William Zabka, who just really I remember playing the blonde bad kid in like every cool 80s movies that there ever was, and I'm sure there wasn't a ton, but
there were only like three that I remember.
Yeah. After his audition, Zabka saw Macho, who noted, Zabka scared the shit out of me during his audition to the studio. When he was cast, William Zabka had amateur wrestling background, but had no previous training in karate. Later in the production group, Valerie Harper was considered for the role of Lucille, Danny LaRusso's mom, but the studio later, put in Randy Heller for the role. Randy Heller.
I know who it is.
Okay.
Thanks. I could name other things she's done as well.
Go ahead. The floor is yours.
She was in a show called Second Chance on Fox in the early days of Fox with Matthew Perry, one of his early roles. She did she was in a nice little show called Clubhouse from the early 2000s. So yeah, she's been around. Well, you know what? You're talking about these. Are you? Let me. Because these casting choices, when you talk,
trying to set this.
No, but
before we get to the actual.
Yeah, you're hitting a nerve here because, like, No, in a good way. Because I'm thinking about all these other people who you're mentioning, and I'm like, they. Look, like I said, hindsight's 20/20, but it wouldn't have worked because you needed people who are not going to suck all the air out of the room or, as they say, chew the scenery. You know, if you cast Crispin Glover in that role, he would eat it up, you know, and he would be too villainous. William Zabka was the perfect high school antagonist. You could tell he wasn't a bad kid. He was just sometimes you get into shit with people, you know.
All right,
wait. But I also want to talk about, because you mentioned Valerie Harper. Valerie Harper was a superstar. You can't put her in that movie because she would own every scene she's in because all eyes would be on her. Like, oh, hey, that's Valerie Harper. You need the right actress. And you mentioned also Demi Moore, who was also a star by then. She would have. You know, Elizabeth Shue was absolutely perfect for it because she wasn't. What?
All right, we're losing downloads in India. Let me ask you this. Hold on, but here's what I would ask you.
Okay.
How much thought is given to casting in a typical movie? You've been in the movie business. So take everybody through. Don't take 20 minutes because we got a lot of cover. But let me ask you, that's what I'm interested in. I mean, because clearly the right casting choice can really make, I won't say break, but make a movie. Schwarzenegger as the Terminator. There's just some real key casting choices. So your experience on a movie set, is it debated for months? Is it one week? How does it, how do they do it?
Well, I think the first of all, it depends how much money they have. So based on the budget, they know who they can afford. But they have to decide what are the roles that need to be, that really casting is super vital. Now, I think that every single role should be cast, you know, with the ultimate precision. But sometimes they don't have the time or the resources to do that. The best example of this, we've talked about it, is the Vacation reboot. Because a great cast can take a lousy script and make it work. But a bad cast can screw up a great script. So it doesn't work the other way around. And I think that's what happened with a movie like Vacation. I think it was very poorly cast across the board. I know you disagree with that, but that's another.
Well,
that's
we've
another
already thing. Got over
right.
Well,
I'm just because I'm right. No, but I'm thinking of what you asked. So sometimes they think the movies are going to sell themselves, so they don't think they need to spend so much time with like the supporting players, or they have enough strength in their, they have enough faith in their lead actor who can like carry the whole thing, but. You know, it just, it always depends on how much time, money, and some people like to cast their friends. Like, look at Adam Sandler. Like, every movie that he makes, he casts his buddies. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but either way, he's still using the same people. So, you know, casting to me is the most important thing because they're the ones who are selling you the bill of goods.
So again, let's go with the notion of a mid-major to major movie.
Okay.
Are people meeting and discussing for weeks about casting choices?
Yep.
But that's what I want to know. Is there a lot of time? Let's say it's a decent sized movie on. Are producers meeting? I mean, are they got a list of 15 people for each role? Are we debating? We got note cards. Are we canceling people out and trying to get it to the last five or
all
six?
All of it. Okay. Everybody has their different process. But every movie, if you look on the opening credits, there's a casting director, and that's the person who is like, kind of like, in a way, similar to the director of photography.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
okay, so
where the director of photography is going to tell the director, I think it's going to look better this way. Okay, so, and the director, and they would collaborate, and, you know, try to come up with the best way, but that, so the casting director will be the one, like, let's say a director comes in, let's say Avildsen comes in, and he says, I want Sylvester Stallone to play the Karate Kid. And the casting director would be like, okay, I just have a few names here that I've been looking at since I was hired a couple weeks ago, and they're gonna say, I think this actor will be perfect for this role, and this guy will be, and the director might be like, or the producer might be like, no, I want a star. And then the casting director will be like, okay, my job is to give you what you want and also tell you what I think you need. So, you know, and that's when it comes down to what the producer wants, what the director wants, how much money they have. It's a humongous process. It's everything you said times 10. Casting is what they labor the most on.
Okay, so here's my last question. Let's keep it 10 minutes or less. Let's just say, I don't care whatever the choice is on a movie set. Who gets final say? Director, producer?
That's a great question.
Or the overall, or the company, the head of the whole movie
set? It could be anybody. For example, if you are, you know, if we were doing Creed 3 and Sylvester Stallone was involved, nothing, even though he's not the writer or director, or I think he wrote Creed 2, but let's say he was just an actor now. Okay, he's just playing Rocky. Nobody's walking onto that set unless it's passed through him. Like, because it's his baby. Even though he's not at the reins anymore, it's still his baby. So when you've got like the biggest star in the world, he doesn't necessarily call the shots, but he certainly has veto power. But in most cases, it's the director, I think. sometimes, and it really depends who the producers are. If the producer's like a super powerful guy, like in the Karate Kid's case, I will bet that Jerry Weintraub had the most say as far as, you know, who was going to be in this movie, because he was a big time producer. He was like a Bruckheimer.
Yeah, well, we know that Jews control Hollywood. So it's a joke. Play it for a comedy. Don't sit there and sell me out.
He said that. I didn't say it.
The film's fight choreographer for the combat scenes was Pat E. Johnson. A Tang Soo Do karate black belt who had worked previously on Bruce Lee's American Hong Kong martial arts film Enter the Dragon, mm-hmm. and had worked with Chuck Norris at the American Tang Soo Do martial arts school. Johnson also made an appearance as the referee in The Karate Kid, mm-hmm. Pat Morita's stunt double for Mr. Miyagi. Fumio Demura is also a karate black belt who had previously worked with Bruce Lee, who had also taught some nunchuck techniques.
Wait, can I guess the name of that guy? Do you have it there?
Who are you asking about?
The guy, the stunt double.
I listed his name, the stunt double.
I think his name is Daryl Vidal.
I got it as Fumio Demura.
You know who Daryl Vidal is? Do you have that anywhere on your thing?
No, I know Vidal Sassoon.
I don't know if there's a relation there, but Daryl Vidal is actually the guy who you see doing the crane kick from a distance on the beach when Daniel's in the water, and he's also one of the competitors in the tournament at the end. He's the guy who Johnny fights in the semifinals. I know my Karate Kid, man.
Oh, is that what that's the guy who does all the flips the jumps?
That's the guy, yep.
Okay. Well, Guerrilla, the final casting was Ralph Macchio as Dan LaRusso, Pat Morita as Mr. Miyagi, Elizabeth Shue as Ally Mills, Martin Cove as John Kreese, Randy Heller as Lucille LaRusso, William Zabka as Johnny Lawrence, Chad McQueen as Dutch, Ron Thomas as Bobby Brown, Rob Garrison as Tommy, and Tony O'Dell as
Jimmy.
Let's get to the plot.
I want to hear what you have to say. What do you think about the Elizabeth Shue casting? Like, what do you have to say about, you know, her over a Demi Moore or some of the people that you mentioned? What do you think?
Well, I'm not going to get into, like, versus Demi Moore, but what I'll keep it brief. Elizabeth Shue, to me, embodies just that image of cute high school girl, sweet, all-American. She's from a rich family, but she's cool. She's, you know, hip with the working class Daniel. So I thought it was a brilliant casting. She did an absolute great job, and I really mm-hmm. bought into the romance. I mean, it's not just a typical blow off, romance that you see in a lot of movies. Like, I actually feel their romance in the movie.
Yep, I agree. I will stack her up against Demi Moore, because I think Demi Moore would have commanded more attention, and Elizabeth Shue kind of blends in, because it's like if you have somebody playing this role who's like hot, like model hot, it's not going to work.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Do you agree, or are you just being you?
Ixnay Avigné, model hotnye.
Well, I think Elizabeth Shue was the perfect combination.
I so badly want to answer. Let me talk to you off air about that.
Okay. Well, I'll just say that Elizabeth Shue was the perfect combination of sort of, like you said, like down home, you know, like because she's not model hot. And she's not supposed to be. She's beautiful.
Well, let me just say this. Is Elizabeth Shue model hot? Cough one time for yes. Cough one time for no. Two times for no.
I coughed once.
Let's move on.
She's model hot
now. You know what?
She's model hot. She's model hot now. Have you seen her lately?
I'd like to, she was in the first season of The Boys, and she's absolutely great, Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah.
You mentioned Elizabeth Shue and Demi Moore. I'd like to actually stack Elizabeth Shue on top of Demi Moore.
I knew. I set you up for that one. I totally set you up They're both pretty stacked, actually.
Yes.
But Shue's are real. Shue's are real.
Demi Moore
is
in the new Michael Bay movie, which the trailer dropped
Sunshine something or Songbird, something like that. I saw it yesterday.
And I'm looking at it, and it intrigues me, because I'd love to see Michael Bay actually do a well-received. I mean, I loved Pain and Gain, which was received better than a lot of his big-budget blow-em-up, that's with The Rock and Mark Wahlberg. Interesting story. But anyway, let me digress. I don't want this to be about Michael Bay. But the trailer interests me, and if I had the opportunity to see it, whether on streaming or at the theater, I would see it.
I thought I was having a dream of the future. It's freaked me out. It really did.
In 1984, Danny LaRusso and his mother Lucille moved from Newark, New Jersey, to Reseda, Los Angeles, California. The apartment handyman is an eccentric but kind and humble Okinawan immigrant named Mr. Miyagi. And I think certainly early on in the movie, the movie does a good job early on, from my perspective, kind of fleshing out that whole East Coast vibe. You know, they sort of let you know they're not from the West Coast.
Yeah, and you know what I also love? And I think it's a little thing, but it works. He never quite accepts the fact that this is where they live. He keeps referring to Newark as where he lives, as home. He's like, I took karate at the Y in Newark where I live. You know, even like he can never truly accept that they've moved, that they don't live in Newark anymore. And I think it works because it gives him something else to be pissed about.
He's clearly, I think he's like a high school senior. So, I mean, don't you think that that's a lot of kids who move very late into their school career? Why are my folks doing this to me?
Absolutely. But it's something that in a lesser script would be forgotten, or a lesser actor would not even think about, because when you're doing that, you don't really think about that stuff. Yes, in reality, of course, but when you're telling a story, you know, you might be like, does this matter? Well, the little things matter. And this was a little thing that rounds out the character so beautifully.
It doesn't matter. Okay.
It doesn't matter.
Daniel befriends Allie Mills, a high school cheerleader who draws the attention of her arrogant ex-boyfriend, Johnny Lawrence.
She looks great in a one piece, by the way.
Who?
She looks great in a one piece. On the beach.
And the top student from the Cobra Kai dojo.
You have to give that a moment. You have to give that a moment.
I'm just going to power through. where he studies a vicious form of karate. And again, we talked about how Elizabeth Shue just exemplifies, at least, the teen cuteness in the movie. Johnny and the Cobra Kai gang continually bully Daniel.
They don't bully him. He asks for it.
Here's the problem. I don't want to get a perspective from Cobra Kai. When I watched the movie back in the day, I felt like Macho portrayed. I've been bullied at school, and I've bullied other kids. I'm not trying to get all deep, but I really felt like he portrayed a kid getting bullied very, 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 very effectively.
Yep. And you're absolutely right. However, okay, the reason that...
Now, we could talk about in Cobra Kai how it shades the film today, but I really still want to give the perspective of watching it in a clean slate, so to speak.
Okay.
But maybe I'm wrong.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong at all, but I can tell you, and I'm being completely honest with you, before Cobra Kai, the series was a twinkle in the writer's eyes.
Don't say it.
I always maintained, and my brother can attest to this. No, of course Johnny's the bad guy, okay? And you always see him that way. But Daniel was never the innocent victim, so to speak. You know?
You.
No, he definitely didn't deserve what he got, okay? But he pushed buttons that a new kid coming out of nowhere probably shouldn't push. But that's what's great about the character, is that he's not perfect. He's not the little wimpy douchebag that, you know, from like No Retreat, No Surrender. Remember that movie? Remember that piece of crap? You know, those are the kinds of mistakes that this movie, that a bad casting move could have made. They could have made him 1,000% sympathetic. But even in his early scenes with Miyagi, he's still a little arrogant, chip on his shoulder kind of kid. Like when he's practicing.
Let me finish.
Okay, like that, like I love that scene and it's such a small scene, but it matters so much. After the morning after the fight that he has, or I think a couple days later, when Miyagi shows up to fix the sink, Daniel's practicing karate, and like he can tell right away that Miyagi sees right through him, and he's looking at him. He's like, you know, Daniel's like giving him like a 1,000-yard stare, and they're kind of sizing each other up, you know. And he's like pissed off that this guy knows that he's lying about the injury. That's a very important part of this movie. Like, and it really sets the stage for what their relationship's gonna be. This is the one guy, we know now that this is the one guy who's not gonna buy Daniel's bullshit. And that's what I love. And that's character development. That's going from point A to point B. And his edge, the chip on his shoulder, the anger in him from going back to, he does briefly mention his father in the movie. And the anger of having to move from Newark, it's all part of it. And Macchio plays it so perfectly. Without Cobra Kai, you're right, it's mostly forgotten. But my brother can tell you, I've always maintained that one of the best things about this movie is that Daniel is not perfect. You guys should see the face Moody's making.
Gru's a big movie fan, so I'm not going to cast too many aspersions on his comments. I think, you know, back in when I saw the movie in 84, I mean, I was team Daniel. Here's what I'll say. I did note in my notes, the scene with the bicycle, you can feel this kid's desperation. Most students in middle school and high school, it's just like, when is it ever going to end? I will agree with you that they do shade the character. He's got a little bit of an edge, whether that's an edge from growing up in the Northeast or an edge, you know, he's clearly not happy, with, you know, the move to the West Coast. You know, I didn't take his, you know, any kind of edge with his relationship with Mr. Miyagi. I think he's completely 100% respectful from this guy, you know, different culture. The only time you see a little bit of his backup with Miyagi is, and again, there is the scene where Miyagi engages with him about karate, but I think initially he refuses to train him.
Yes.
And then Daniel's very upset. He's like, you're going to introduce me to this world of self-defense and karate, but you're not gonna fucking help me. And screw you. You know I'm getting my ass beat.
Actually, wait a second. Actually, that's a little, I don't mean to be like this, but that's a little off, because the argument was...
Of course
was,
it is. Well, the argument... Moody had to say so.
No, no, no.
Well, fuck you. Let's get into the karate ring. I'll beat your ass.
Of course you will. Because that was about... That problem was because Miyagi had just kicked the shit out of the Cobra Kids. And now, we're having a conversation here. So what Daniel was pissed off, he's like, oh, you're not going to come down there with me? Now I got to carry your weight too. So I'm going to go down there, talk to the teacher after you beat the shit out of his kids. So fine, thanks for nothing. That's basically what he says. But if you remember, wait one second, just before I forget it. If you remember, okay, he doesn't believe that Miyagi was the guy who saved his ass before. He writes it off. And then as Miyagi starts talking to him, he starts believing in him. So until then, he just looks at this guy as the handyman. Even though he is hanging out with him a little bit with the Halloween costume and everything, he doesn't see the guy for who he is yet. You know what I mean?
Doesn't Miyagi, if I may interject, doesn't Miyagi decline to train him, but Miyagi agrees to bring him to Cobra Kai, where he's going to broker this peace agreement, or try to broker a peace agreement between Daniel and the bullies.
You've got things a little mixed up. The answer is yes to all of it, but
I'm
not
looking
enough.
At my notes. I mean, I got
I'm
my
telling
notes
you.
From
I'm
verified websites.
But listen. Here's the way it goes. God. I know the scene very well because it's actually probably my favorite scene in the movie because if you look at that scene, okay, when he's, you know, it begins when he's lying on whatever it is and he's got the headband, you know, Miyagi's kind of nursing him back to health. It's one take. One take from beginning to end. They do not stop. It's like 5 minutes long. That's unheard of these days. And even back then, like, they didn't film things like that. They would do things in different segments. So when he's there and he realizes and they start talking about things, he's like, you want to train me? He's like, it depends on what? The reason. He's like, how's revenge? And Miyagi's like, no, that's not what karate's about. And, then he says, well, will you at least go with me to, you know, talk to these guys to see what to see if we can stop this. And at first Miyagi says no, he doesn't want to get involved. But then Daniel convinces him by saying what I told you, he said. He's like, thanks for nothing. You just beat the crap out of these guys.
Okay, that's
and now it's time. But wait. So, but they didn't even talk about training yet because the idea of the tournament wasn't even on the table. It's only when they go to the dojo and Miyagi sees the poster and he's like, okay, we do tournament. Then he says, okay, now we're going to do this. That's how we're going to settle it. We're going to settle it at this tournament. So yes, I got you into this and I'm going to train you. Before then, it wasn't, you know, they didn't even know what they were getting themselves into. That's
okay.
The way I look at it.
I publicly apologize. Miyagi declines, but agrees to bring Daniel to the Cobra Kai dojo to resolve the conflict. They meet with the sensei, John Kreese, an ex-Special Forces Vietnam veteran who callously dismisses the peace offering. Miyagi then proposes that Daniel enter the All Valley Karate Championships, where he can compete with Johnny and the other Cobra Kai students on equal terms, and requests that the bullying cease while Daniel trains. Kreese agrees to the terms, but warns that if Daniel does not show up for the tournament, the harassment will continue for both Daniel and Miyagi. So I stand corrected. Are you happy now?
I'm thrilled.
You're gonna fucking break me down.
Hey.
What's the truth?
Hello.
All right. Well, let's get to it. Daniel's training starts with days of menial chores, Gru, that he believes only serve him to make Miyagi's unpaid employee. When he becomes frustrated, Miyagi demonstrates that repetition of these chores have helped him to learn defensive blocks through muscle memory, and their bond develops. And so, again, I mean, a young kid – I was 13 years old, and when he finally, Daniel confronts Mr. Miyagi, says, I'm sick of waxing, and all of a sudden, Daniel's son, and they go through these, I mean, I'm just talking about it now, I got a little burst, I mean,
I still get goosebumps. Every time I think about that scene or watch it, I remember seeing it for the first time and being just as shocked as Daniel was. That's just brilliant writing right there. There's nothing I can say about that scene that hasn't already been said. It's so perfect because it changes everything and it really breaks up the movie. Now you're going into like the second act, of the movie after that. But, I use that, look, I'm a teacher. I use that as, you know, when kids complain about the kind of work that they do, like, where, how is this going to help us in the real world? How's algebra going to help me, you know, do my taxes? And my thing is, I kind of like sometimes show that scene. I'm saying you're training your brain to do things like do your taxes. So when you are confronted with a problem, you don't just get overwhelmed. You say, okay, I can relax, center myself, and figure this out. That's what you're learning how to learn. And that's what's great about that scene. He's training without, you know, he's learning that training is that exactly what Miyagi says, not everything is as seen. That's like such a major idea from this movie. And this scene is, you know, so few movies have these kinds of scenes that just last forever and never let you down. And this is one of them. I remember, like I said, I remember the first time seeing it, my jaw dropped. You know?
Well, my jaw dropped when I went to
I know.
McDonald's yesterday.
A lot more drop than that.
It's funny you mention about students, because one time I had a kid say to me, hey, when am I going to need this biology? And I was like, you know what? Let's watch a movie. And I put on I put on Howard Stern's Private Parts. And
the kielbasa scene?
I watched the scene of the first naked woman on radio. And the kid said to me, well, how does this still help me? And I went, oh, it doesn't.
I just wanted to watch.
I wanted to kill 7 minutes. You know,
Is it time for lunch yet?
And then the principal said, "Mr. Rudy, I'd like to come see you for your
your observation." Yeah, surprise. Yeah,
well, let's get back to it, Gru. That the bond develops between Miyagi and Daniel LaRusso as Miyagi opens up to Daniel about his life, which includes the loss of his wife and son in childbirth. At the Manzanar internment camp while he was serving with the 42nd Infantry Regiment during World War II.
442nd. I'm sorry, I have to correct that because that's
442nd.
That's not against you.
Jesus Christ.
I'm sorry. As a history teacher, I have to correct you on that one. I'm sorry.
I wanted to know, did he serve in the internment camp with George Takei?
Probably. No, Miyagi was older. I think Miyagi's older than George.
I love when I try to shuffle in a joke, and now he wants to be serious. Like, ooh.
Well, now stepped over Miyagi and I worked together in the internment camp. He was very svelte, and he had a beautiful smile. So I guess they did work together.
In the Rambles in Central Park.
Introduced me to Brad, my husband.
Brad and I have a light petting and wrestling semi-clad on our bed. This is getting into a talk.
I would love it if George Takei could be our announcer. We should get him on Cameo.
Message him on Instagram. We never know.
Yeah, we should get him on Cameo.
All right, so now we're getting into a little bit, you know, your training montages through Mr. Miyagi's teaching. Daniel learns not only karate, but the important life lessons such as the importance of personal balance, reflected in the principle that martial arts training is as much about training the spirit as the body. Daniel applies the life lessons that Miyagi has taught him to strengthen his relationship with Ali. On Daniel's 16th birthday, Miyagi presents him with a karate gi for the tournament and one of his own cars as a birthday gift, which is a wonderful scene. But upon reflection, I mean, I'm just going to give you a brand new car. I don't know if I buy into that one completely. I love it. But when I looked at it again, I was like, oh, hey, I barely know you. I've been training you for 2 weeks. Here's a new classic Ford LT 1961, completely buffed out.
Yeah, well,
worth $80,000.
You're not wrong at all, but they do kind of set it up from the beginning, because the first time they go to Miyagi's house, there's a short moment where Miyagi sees Daniel admiring that car, like really looking at it like it's like he's loving it, and you see Miyagi kind of smile. So that kind of sets up that moment. The whole thing is strange if you look at it from today's point of view. A 16-year-old kid spending all his time with a 60-year-old guy.
Oh, don't go there.
No, I'm just saying, cause I absolutely do too, but you don't see that in pop culture today.
Well, okay, if you really want to be honest about it, you're not going to see perhaps this movie made again, because I think that the role of Mr. Miyagi would be seen as somewhat stereotypical to Asian Americans. And again, he's helping a white boy and who may have white I mean, if you really want to get down to it, I don't want to get stuck on it, but I don't know. This is a great story, but perhaps the thought police or the political correct police would even look at a story like this and perhaps knock it for
its lack of diversity.
Which I don't agree with, but I don't know if you have any thoughts about what I just said.
No, I think you're 100% right. I think, a story is a story for better or worse. A lack of diversity, doesn't, like, if it were made today, which technically it kind of was, it was 10 years ago already, but, you know, it's like there aren't, I think there's one African-American in this entire movie, and he doesn't even have a line. It's one of the Cobra guys. It's, a matter of fact, you know who it is? It's, oh, God. Well, for Revenge of the Nerds, who Lamar. Sang the song? Lamar is one of the, Larry B. Scott is the actor's name. He's a Cobra, but I don't think he has any lines. It's the only African-American in the movie that I could think of, and that would never fly today. But you don't see anybody complaining about it because they don't see color in this. They don't, the movie's so good that you don't see the stereotypes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just saying to make it, to boil it down, forgetting, let's say, the overall diversity of the characters in the movie, I just think today you would have a hard time making a movie about a wise, old Asian mentor to a white kid who,
yes,
you know, again, you know, they're going to say, oh, saving a white kid. I just don't know, yeah, if it would be made.
I think you're right.
And I think overall there's a terrific story to be had there.
100%. I agree with you totally.
All right. At the tournament, the All Valley Karate Tournament, Daniel surprises everyone by reaching the semifinals. Johnny advances to the finals, scoring 3 unanswered points against Daryl Vidal. Great call, Andrew. Excuse me.
He can never compliment me without some kind of...
Kreese instructs in actually a excellent, excellent scene. Kreese instructs his second best student, Bobby Brown.
My prerogative. My prerogatives. Hey, new edition. Let's go.
Vito, man. What's that go? That Ghostbusters 2 song.
We got to make it on the road. Oh my God,
yeah,
that's terrible.
Bobby Brown, rest in peace, Whitney Houston. Oh! All right, anyway.
And Bobby Christina.
Yeah, well, yeah. Actually, that is kind of sad. Marie's a huge Whitney fan. All right, so Kreese instructs Bobby, who is one of the more, actually, I think, the compassionate Cobra Kai student and the least vicious of Daniel's tormentors, to disable Daniel with an illegal attack to the knee. Bobby reluctantly does so, severely injuring Daniel and getting himself disqualified in the process. I actually remembered that scene, like, ooh, there's a little bit of redemption in a villain.
Yep.
Andrew, any thoughts on what I'm saying here?
Yes, and you're going to hate me for this, but, you know,
Why do you always say hate?
Because you hate it when
I disagree with you, but you're my best friend.
It's not about that. It's not about that.
If you're going to say something controversial just for saying it.
No, it's not going to be controversial. I actually tweeted back and forth with the actor Ron Thomas, who played Bobby, and I actually, because I was struck by it, because I watched The Karate Kid not long ago, maybe like 3 weeks ago.
So,
and
why
did
you tell him to come on our podcast?
Well, no, I don't know.
Do something for
the kid. I don't think we had planned this one yet.
He's Jackie the Joke Man.
But anyway, what did
Ron have to say?
What did Sensei Ron Thomas actually said, because I had mentioned that it's interesting that towards the beginning, like in the soccer scene, when he's trying out for the soccer team, Bobby actually starts a fight with him. He sly tackles him and he like plans it. You could see he's being kind of a dick about it. But as time goes on and he realizes like this is going too far, Bobby actually has a journey. Even though he's a really minor secondary character, the actor, Ron Thomas, sort of gives him this nuance and takes him from point A to point B.
I would say,
so that's why I love...
Hold on, may I comment?
Yeah,
nuance,
please.
Yes. There's not enough there, I think, to call it a legitimate journey, though.
No, okay, all right. Journey is too big of a word, but that's an example of what an actor, you know, a choice an actor makes, like, what am I going to do with this little part that I've got? And then I love, like, at the, like, you see the part when they beat the crap out of him where Miyagi saves him. Bobby's the one saying, stop, he can't even stand up. You know, this is, leave him alone, he's got enough, what's wrong with you? And then at the end, you know, he wants to beat him legitimately. And then when you see, when Kreese tells him, put him out of commission, then Bobby goes out into the, onto the ring, and you can see Bobby's, like, deflated. He's, like, so not wanting to do this, and that, I just love that. Like, just like you were saying, it's an amazing thing that wouldn't be considered important today. Like, it, you know, and that's why I love it so much.
I don't know if it would be, wouldn't be considered important, but what I would ask you is, did you ask the actor about that scene and what was his thoughts?
He never asked me. He just kind of, like, liked the tweet. He never answered me. I just felt like saying something because I thought it was really a great acting choice, and it added something to the movie. It definitely did. You know?
Daniel Grew is taken to the locker room where the physician determines that he cannot continue. However, Daniel believes that if he quits, his tormentors have gotten the best of him. He convinces Miyagi to use a pain suppression technique to allow him to continue. And as you remember, Mr. Miyagi slaps his hands and with friction rubs his hands, and then he touches Daniel inappropriately. And Daniel says, wait, I'm starting to feel things like I climbed the rope in gym class. Oh, wait. Oh, that was the deleted industrial cut scene from the DVD. And I want to say that nothing worthwhile neither endorses or promotes anything on the show, even though we do supply 100% of its content. Anyway, before we get to the final, anything about the paints, it's sort of a fun, gimmicky, you know, the whole hand clappy thing. It's been a thing that's been probably a meme, and, you know, it's certainly a unique scene and a fun scene.
It's just, to me, it's great directing, great writing, because everything, it's like setup, payoff. So this is a payoff for that moment where he's, you know, the scene when they're arguing in the garden, and he's like showing them that the wax on, wax off thing is actually, and he's like, I can't move my arm. So that's when he first does the thing, and then he fixes them, and then he can do it. And this is a perfect, perfectly timed and played out payoff for that moment. It's just perfect writing, and I remember when he hit, when that thing hits and the music starts, the crowd erupted. Do you remember? I think we talked the other day about this, and I think we saw the movie in the same theater at the same time. We just didn't realize it. Because it was during summer camp.
Yeah. Before I get to that, I wanted, because hearing your comments about the locker room scene, I also feel it's a pivotal scene. It's one of the prior I really enjoy because, again, Ali and the mother also play a pivotal role because they're so complimentary. And the mother, it reminds me of something my own mom would say, which is, you know, you gave it your all. You don't need to go out there and fight. You don't need to prove anything. You're my son. You've already won. And even Miyagi says, you know, it's over. You did what you had to do. And he understands that in order to really exercise the demons, he's got to see this thing all the way through for better or for worse. And then, of course, you get the payoff with the hands and the pain suppression. So before we move on to the final climax of the movie, so to speak, any thoughts on, you know, sort of that whole scene with everyone telling him he's won his journey. No more. You no need to fight. You know, you surpassed expectations. And his thing is, no, I got to see this through.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, I can imagine, you know, you being there and your mom saying, yeah, you did great, honey. And your dad saying, you fucking loser. You know, but in any case, it's really sorry I couldn't get you your fucking trophy. It's really the first time that Daniel doesn't take, he sort of turns the, actually no, I'm wrong. Because I was going to say, it's the first time Daniel kind of overrules Miyagi. And Miyagi realizes that Daniel's right. But that does happen before. It happened.
Good point.
But it happened that one time before. It happened when he first got him to train him. You know, Miyagi first says no, then Daniel says, you basically just threw me under the bus. And so Miyagi realizes he's right, so he goes with him to the dojo. Maybe this is a payoff for that as well. Maybe they're related. I don't know. But that's what makes it a great scene, because Daniel has finally come full circle, and he's like, I don't have to go out there to beat the shit out of Johnny. I need to go out there and, like you said, exercise this demon. I got to finish it. Win, lose, draw, doesn't matter. I just have to be. It's like, that's where the Rocky comparison stands in. I got to be standing at the end of the, when the bell rings. I gotta, when it's over, no matter what happens, doesn't matter if he opens my head or nothing, I gotta be in the ring standing knowing that I gave it my all and earn that respect. And Miyagi realizes that that's what he's been teaching them all this time, to earn the respect of the opponent. Because you can see when Daniel goes back into the ring, after, you know, the Daniel Russo's gonna fight, he goes back into the ring, Johnny's still treating him kind of like a little bitch, you know? And that's why Daniel needed to get out there. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I want to apologize to our listeners for the coarse language that was heard in the last segment.
I fully admit I am definitely a Karate Kid snob.
I am only joking around. Let's see here. As Johnny is about to be declared the winner by default, Daniel comes out with this whole cadre, a deliciously chunky Elizabeth Shue in her little high school sweater, clinging to all of... Oh, excuse me.
It's my future ex-wife you're talking about.
Mrs. LaRusso, they all come out, and Daniel's going to fight. The match is a seesaw battle, with neither able to break through the other's defense. The match is halted when Daniel uses a scissor leg technique to trip Johnny, delivering a blow to the back of his head, giving Johnny a nosebleed. Carice directs Johnny to sweep Daniel's injured leg, what would be considered an unethical move in karate. Johnny looks horrified at the order, but reluctantly agrees. As the match resumes and the score is tied 2-2, Johnny seizes Daniel's leg and deals a vicious elbow, doing further damage. Daniel, standing with difficulty, assumes the crane stance, a technique he observed Mr. Miyagi performing on a beach. Before we get to that final, do we see a little redemption in Johnny as well?
Yes, and you know what? I have to, remember, you know, again, there's a Rocky connection here.
Can I get to my thoughts?
You asked me a question. I'm trying to answer it.
Well, you're going back to my Rocky thoughts. I have notes on Rocky.
All right. The answer is, there are two things I want to say before you move on. Okay. Yes. The answer to your question is yes. There's definitely a redemptive moment for Johnny. Where'd you go? Oh, there you are. I thought you walked away. Yes. Definitely a redemptive moment for Johnny. And I just have a question, because you mentioned that he comes out with Ali, and I will ignore the weight remark for Ali. Elizabeth, I'm very sorry. I apologize for my partner. I think that Ali and his mother were probably as surprised as everybody else, because didn't they exit the locker room?
I feel like the scene as they're about to announce Johnny the winner, doesn't Elizabeth Shue kind of sprint?
Oh, you're right. Yep.
Like,
yep.
Yeah. Yes. Like, you know.
Yeah. You're right.
I won't say sprint, but
no, yeah, she runs out there. She runs out there, boobies shaking. Yeah, definitely. Oh, wait.
I mean, it's the damn truth. So
You gotta call it what it is.
There's a beautifulness and a sexuality to Elizabeth Shue, I don't even know how old she was, but I mean,
I think she was in her early 20s. They all were. They were all like in their early 20s.
To deny it would be just foolish.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. We gotta be honest on this podcast.
I found my official notes where I wrote about John Avildsen and the obvious comparison to Rocky. So here's what I wrote. The wise old coach, mentor, romance, tough macho villains, some humor interspersed throughout the movie, notion of classism, wealth, poverty, and music montages.
Yes.
So that's what I wrote on my thoughts of the Karate Kid Rocky comparison.
Yeah, and I think that, and what I was about to say for this scene in particular, when I compare the scene where Johnny is horrified at the idea of hurting Daniel intentionally and illegally at the suggestion of his coach, I compare it to when, in the last round of the original fight in the first Rocky, when Apollo's manager is saying, you know, we got to stop this thing. He's hurting you. Like, you're bleeding inside. We got to stop it. And he's like, no, I got to do it. I got to do it. Like, it's like pride now. It's about doing the right thing. It's about standing up and being a man. And it's like defiance in the face of destruction. And I see a comparison there. They're giving what Avildsen's doing, or at least the writing is doing, is it's giving us it's putting a human face on the bad guy. And it's giving us a moment with him to realize that he's going through some shit too. And that's so important in movies like this. So I do see that connection.
I don't see the connection with Apollo in that sense, but I do agree with you that it shades the character. I mean,
yes.
It's to quote Billy Joel, there's shades of gray there. And mm-hmm. every bad guy, it doesn't have to be 100% brutal creep. And every good guy doesn't have to be completely Johnny Appleseed.
And you know what? No movie exemplifies what you just said better than The Karate Kid.
Okay, agreed. And I think even as a young kid watching the movie, I'm like, maybe Johnny's not a dick after all. Now, we'll talk about it further in other episodes, but even at 14, 13, I was kind of heartened to see that, you know, Johnny wasn't a complete douche, creep.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and it's very difficult to look at it these days without looking at it through the lens of...
Well, you don't remember I still remember fairly clearly to this day when I sitting in the movie theater as a young kid. Again, my sophistication level, while I'm not sophisticated in the least, I will say my sophistication level has somewhat increased in my older age. But I remember buying it to Johnny straight up as a villain, didn't see any of the nuances until, you know, with Cobra Kai, until the very end. I saw Johnny as a complete creep. At the very end, I was like, whoa, he's got a little bit of heart. He doesn't want to do what's wrong.
Yeah, I think that when I first saw it and when I was younger, before I was a movie snob like I am now, I definitely felt the same way. But as time went on, even way before Cobra Kai and even before Karate Kid 2, when you see the opening, you know, we'll get to that later. But I never hated Johnny. I was afraid of him. There's a difference. And I remember there were times, like, even when I first saw it, when Daniel, like, pours the water on him in the bathroom, I was like, while most people were like clapping, I was like, what are you doing, you fucking idiot? Like, why are you poking the bear? You know, I mean, obviously I didn't use that term when I was 9 years old, but I was like, no, he's going to kill you. Don't do it. You know, like that was a stupid thing to do. Like, you couldn't, like, and Johnny actually says you couldn't leave well enough alone, you know?
I just want to apologize to our Nothing Worthwhile listeners for the coarse language that just went over our airwaves.
Yeah, for some, would you think, you know, we always average like one or two F-bombs a show.
No,
would
I
you
don't
think
know,
it's the that. Would you think it's the Karate Kid that's bringing out so much bad,
no, but
bad language?
I mean, you know, I probably as a 14-year-old, 13-year-old, you know, when I'm watching Dan LaRusso take a hose line, I was probably like, well, you're smoking pot. That's wrong anyway. And, I mean, part of me probably knew, you know, he's instigating, but, I mean, he had a little bit of a reason to. So, I mean, that's fodder for further.
But do you understand but do you agree with me or disagree with me that when I say that, like, I didn't hate Johnny, but I did fear him? Does that make sense?
Well,
I hated
Willie Zabka.
I definitely hated Kreese.
William Zabka he had, as far, and again, I don't know, I don't want to get into his filmography, But when you say to me 80s high school blonde villain, William Zabka was the dude.
Okay.
I kind of feared him too, because I certainly, if I was in high school, I would avoid a kid like that because I didn't want to get my ass beat.
Yes, but bullied. Here's what I'm going to say, and I'm only going to use the filmography for this purpose. God. I'm sorry, but I have to. Okay. And I actually had this conversation with somebody recently. Because of Cobra Kai, I love talking about this universe. So William Zabka played it so beautifully because his character, the character of Johnny, while lumped in with some of Zabka's other work, like Chaz and Back to School and Greg Tolan and Just One of the Guys, they're always lumped together, but they are nothing alike. The characters from those other two movies are absolute irredeemable douchebags from the get-go. They are pure badness and pure villainy. You never get that from Johnny. Johnny was not bothering anybody until Daniel kind of stepped in and got in his face. You know? What?
You're going to really take this podcast?
No. I'm just pointing out the difference between this character and the other ones. Okay? This is a deep... This. I didn't need... I mean... Cobra Kai really does go deep into Johnny's past, obviously, so we're not going to go there. But I knew over the years that there was more to Johnny than just what most people saw. That I'm being very honest with that, and it's because of how well William Zabka played the part.
Thank you, Gore Vidal. He was the one guy at nine years old when the kids were like, I made poopy in my pants. He was like, William Zabka's stunning portrayal of Johnny was both nuanced and stunning. Johnny Lawrence was both. Now pass me my Jell-O dessert.
I'm like Roger Ebert all of a sudden. I'm listening to myself, and I'm like, holy shit, I am a Karate Kid snob. Like, I'm disappointed in myself. I'm impressed with my knowledge, but...
Here's what I've been able to quantify as a viewer. My experience at 13 was much different than watching Cobra Kai a couple of months ago. And
yes.
I don't know. I mean, for you to say that, I think is pretty wild. I mean, you're going to, you know, I mean, when I see Cobra Kai, I looked at it a lot differently. At the time, at 13, I was like, oh, they're bad. Those are bad guys. And I was on Team Daniel. A 9-year-old Andy, you know, fresh out of the womb, saw it differently. He was so, intellectually nuanced at 9 years old, but maybe it was that education at Friends Academy. I don't know. I had to go to public school.
Like, no, that was Karate Kid came out way before I went to Friends Academy, but...
I'm only playing.
But I will say this, that, okay, maybe I'll amend it a little bit. But this is how I felt. Johnny was the kind of antagonist who I wanted to like, because he wasn't hateful. He was just angry. And him and Daniel, I think, have more in common than we thought. So I remember at the time, he was the kind of guy, like, I wish this guy was on my side. Because he probably is a good kid deep down. He's just, you know, he's been pulled into this, you know, bit of nonsense by people. So, and I love that, like, you know what it reminds me of a little bit? Iceman in Top Gun. Val Kilmer. You know, he's a bad guy most of the movie, and then they're friends, you know, when they're facing the real villain. You know? I always love that character in movies. Like, the good guy, the bad guy turning good, like, the face turn. I always root for that to happen when it's a villain that we respect. Like, does Johnny take any... Let me ask you this. Throughout the movie, does Johnny take any real cheap shots that you remember?
I mean, I listen, Andy.
I'm trying to remember. The only cheap shot, the only real cheap shot.
Doesn't he? The only one. Doesn't he take this? Doesn't he? Well, you asked me a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did he not? Did he not kind of push him or take the radio and hit him at the beach?
Well, Daniel was getting in his face, but yeah, he was a little over aggressive. That's definitely true. But if you look at that fight, okay, until Daniel sucker punches him. When Daniel's on the ground.
I don't want to get into this.
No, we're talking about the movie, right?
Because, okay, but I just find it hard to, I'm saying at 13, I saw it really, I mean, if you're going to tell me at nine years old, you were like, oh, Johnny's not such a bad guy.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying I didn't hate him, but I was afraid of him. But what I'm going to say now.
You're telling me now, did he take a cheap shot? I don't know. I mean, listen, the scene okay. with the bathroom, I understand he gets water, but they go and they, with like a 9-on-1 pack job
right.
and viciously beat
yeah.
him down.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. There was only one time I remember really looking at Johnny and saying, you piece of shit. And that was when he put the moves on Allie at the country club. To me, that was the worst. That was like the worst thing he did in the move. Everything else was, in a way, provoked. You know, that doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it right. But the only time I really hated him and wanted to punch him myself was when he like kissed Allie just to stick it to Daniel.
Yeah, there's your high school teacher, Mr. Gruthius.
What?
It's okay to beat somebody up.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, for God's sake.
I just want to say again, nothing worthwhile neither endorses nor condemns these viewpoints. Nothing worthwhile, LT 2020. All rights reserved. look, well, we, of course, we have the very famous crane stance. Johnny lunges towards Daniel, who jumps and executes a front kick to Johnny's face, scoring the tournament-winning point. Johnny, having gained newfound respect for his nemesis, does the right thing and presents the trophy to Daniel himself as Daniel is carried off by an enthusiastic crowd.
Tears were flowing. Definitely.
Well, and again, I would say as a viewer back then, again, you get a couple of redemptive points because Johnny does go over and does the right thing in terms of sportsmanship and presents Daniel with the trophy. Doesn't he say to him something to the effect, yep. like, you're okay, kid?
Yeah, you're all right, LaRusso. Good match. That's what he
okay.
says.
You know, so there I'll buy into, you know, you're like, whoa, you know, this guy's ultimately he's maybe not a bad kid.
Yeah, well, I'm just – look, we're looking at it. Here, 30-something years later, and it's really a very difficult thing for me to get into the mindset of when I first saw it. I'm trying. It's tough not to look at it from an adult point of view, and, you know, I see the troubled kid, much more troubled than Daniel in many ways. And that's because,
how would you know that? How
because
you don't have any
because,
background to the character? They
because,
do Cobra Kai,
because,
but at that point you don't see him at home. You don't see an alcoholic father. You don't know anything about him except he's a student at a dojo that the movie portrays as teaching unethical karate. That's how the movie
yes.
portrays it. You don't
yes.
know anything else really about John.
Yeah, and like I said. It's very difficult not to see that now, and I'm trying. It's just very difficult not to see it now, and could
well,
you see?
My point is, where I'm calling a little bit of BS on your comments is that at 9 years old, somehow, when we had the film circle and we were discussing, you were like,
no.
I'm smoking a clove cigarette.
Actually, besides, you know, I like I said, I didn't hate Johnny, but there were two of the Cobra guys that I did hate who seemed to be pure evil. And that was Tommy, the body bags guy.
Yes.
Who unfortunately
yes,
passed away. The actor passed away recently. And Dutch, Chad McQueen. They were the ones who wanted to kill Daniel by the, you know, on the Halloween night. They were just scumbags. And the more blood, those guys were into it. And you could even see that, especially in Dutch, as the movie goes on. Everybody else is kind of moving towards, like, respecting this kid for getting knocked down and keep standing up. Dutch is always like, you little piece of shit, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to destroy you. Even in that locker room scene before the it's one of my favorite lines before they go out. He's like, oh, look, it's our old friend Danielle. Hello, Danielle. I love that part. It's so deliciously evil. So him I hated, and Tommy I hated. But Bobby, we see the redemptive qualities, and Johnny we do too. You know, Johnny sometimes, if you look at it, he's sometimes kind of standing in the background, especially in that last locker room scene there. So there's a lot of stuff going on in this movie.
Well, coming up next week, Andy's going to break down Sesame Street, 1970.
Bert was the real villain.
Apparently so. Apparently so. All right, well, that takes us to the end of The Karate Kid. What did we learn today, Andy?
Well, we learned that it wasn't really Pat Morita who was doing the crane kick on the beach.
Yes, it was Darryl Vidal.
We learned that not everything is as seem. We learned that I really watched way too much TV and movies.
No. We did learn that apparently there was a very controversial locker room scene between Daniel and Jimmy
Adams
that was cut from the original movie. So,
but
let me ask you a question here.
Yeah, go ahead.
To bring it to towards a wrap up. And again, we're going back a ways, but at the end of Karate Kid, did you get a sense of wanting to see more and wanting to see a sequel to see where perhaps some of the characters are going? Because I don't remember getting that vibe. We're going a ways back. But before we start, we get into Karate Kid 2. At the end of Karate Kid, and again, we're super young, but, I mean, was there certain movies you see and you go, wow, sequel, the way they wrapped it up, certainly there's fodder for more storyline. And maybe you have to reflect back to you, but what were your did you expect a sequel deal on this one?
Absolutely not. But it's not like that would be, it's not like I walked out of the theater at 9 years old and be like, well, they could leave it right there. They don't need to have a sequel. It just didn't cross my mind because the story comes full circle. Where else are you going to go with it? Obviously, my creativity at the time, or still, is not even near the level of the guys of the people who have taken it in directions that, you know, we could never even imagine. But no, I never expected there to be any kind of continuation. There would be no reason to.
Well, Andy, despite Andy's thoughts, the movie franchise moves on. Next week, we will discuss 1986 follow-up, The Karate Kid 2, starring Pat Morita, Ralph Macchio, Martin Kove, and William Zabka, also directed by John G. Avildsen. Gru, want to paint a little picture of Karate Kid 2 before we say a fond adieu?
Yeah, Karate Kid 2 is a very interesting sequel because, in and of itself, it's a pretty good movie. But as a sequel to Karate Kid, it's got some major flaws, and I'm looking forward to talking about them next week. But it's certainly interesting. When I first heard that they were making a sequel, it was definitely like, oh, I can't wait. You know.
No, you did the perfect tease because now you got me intrigued. I want to hear your thoughts because I like what you said there. So all right. That's it. You wanna take us out of here?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen of the United States and India, it's been our pleasure as always. Evan and I love to talk about these things that we grew up on to try to, you know, look at them in a new light and see what we discover by talking to each other about these things, and we're thankful for all of you for giving us the platform to do so.
Yes.
Yes.
I am.
And especially the good folks at Spreaker.com who support this podcast. You too can make a podcast. Just go to Spreaker.com. Check it out.
What do you want to promote? Further competition? Come on, what's wrong with you?
No, well, we gotta support each other. You know, this is not like, it's not like the old Howard Stern days where everybody was a competitor. I don't think there's a ratings thing.
Yeah, but I kind of would, I would welcome a podcast war. Actually, I would, I'd love to take on, I don't know.
AJ Benza?
Podcast.
AJ Benza?
I take on AJ Benza.
Yeah, hell yeah.
I mean,
but in any case, next week we're coming back at you with the Karate Kid Part 2, where Daniel and Mr. Miyagi go to Okinawa. What's going to happen there? The mirth, merriment, and adventure continues. And until then, ladies and gentlemen, this is Nothing Worthwhile, Moody and Gru, saying 1, 2, 3.
Quack, quack. I don't know what else to say.